Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Isabel Sanosi, Malawian by origin, Zimbabwean bred, and currently resident in France. Isabel is a people management and organizational development professional with over 15 years of experience in East and Southern Africa, the Middle East, and Europe. Although her career started in the private sector, her experience has largely been in development and nonprofit organizations, progressing gradually from administrative to strategic roles, covering the full spectrum of human resources management. In the past 6 years, the focus of her work has been in leading and supporting strategic processes aimed at aligning structures, policies, systems, and people to strengthen overall organizational performance. Izzy, it's great to have you on Tolerable Risk. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's really good to be here.
For those who are listening today who aren't familiar with you and your background, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you found yourself in the third sector?
Well, as you said, I am Malawian by origin. I come from a really close-knit family. So having worked in different locations has made it a little bit difficult being away from family, but I truly appreciate some of the experiences I've had working in different countries. And I think that is quite essential for HR, especially when they are in a global role. It is quite crucial to understand the different functions of HR as they relate to the context you're working in. So that's been one of the highlights of my career. I started off in marketing and public relations because I'm still testing out what they wanted to do in terms of career. It didn't quite turn out to be what I thought it would be. So I found myself in an office management role with a small family-owned architecture company. And that's where my experience with HR started because it was a role that did everything. You know, when you're in a family-owned business, it can run from payroll to recruitment to getting purchases for the office. So it was quite a dynamic role. And as I grew older, as I worked through my career, it sort of took a natural turn to HR because I've been told I've got a natural feel for talking to people. So I have moved from working in the private sector and I had a keen interest to expand my experience in different sectors. And when an opportunity to work in a third sector company popped up, I immediately took that up and it turned out to be a great career move because this is where my career really took off. The organization was quite a small offshoot from a Southern Africa regional program. It grew into a country program, an independent country program. And as the organization established itself, they also created an HR department. So I was promoted and had the opportunity to set up the department. I had little HR expertise or experience at that time. So I was fumbling my way about, but I think that was the best way to learn how to be an HR practitioner. And then I eventually substantiated that with qualifications. I took HR courses, I took a bit degree. And 5 years later, the organization had a fully functioning HR function and I moved on to another nonprofit organization. So that's sort of how my career has moved on to where I am today, which is with an international organization where I manage the day-to-day functions of the HR team there.
That's such a wonderful backstory. I absolutely can see the connection between starting at a small family-owned business and working in a nonprofit organization where you are responsible, no matter what it is your title says, you're responsible for doing pretty much anything that needs to be done. So that sounds like probably the best preparation for working in the third sector that I could ever think of.
Exactly, exactly. That's quite true.
So we're going to talk about HR and risk in the HR area today. Can you talk a little bit about some of the differences that you have experienced from the private sector to the third sector?
Yeah, in general, I find that as people are central to an organization's operations, they are critical to its success, right? So talent management is really critical to risk management when it comes to governance and ethics. What I find, regardless of whether it's private sector or the third sector, is that the link between HR and the institutional risk is often an afterthought. It's reactive when something goes wrong. The key difference I have found from my own personal working experience is the private sector tends to be a bit more rigid, but in a good way, in terms of structures and processes and reviewing what HR risks are part of the systematic management of an organization. The third sector, on the other hand, is a little bit more fluid. And I think that comes with working in an environment where you're dealing with human rights, people's rights. So there's a bit more flexibility about how some things turn out. And that then spills into how HR risks are managed. So there tends to be less structure, less forward planning, less analysis of HR risks and how they relate to the business strategy. I would say that's a main risk. That's the main thing I've seen as a difference between the private sector and the development sector. But essentially, in either case, there is less focus given to HR risk than is given to financial risk in an organization. So the minute you mention financial risk leadership, the board, everybody is pulling together to make sure that it is managed. But HR seems to be kind of a forgotten side, regardless of the fact that people are central to the success of the business. So that's what I'm seeing in terms of my experience.
I think that is such an interesting statement that you said when you said HR is an afterthought when it comes to reviewing institutional risk. When you say it, it makes sense, right? People go, well, yeah, but like you said, finance and procurement and sanctions compliance would all be a top of mind. But organizations are made up of people. And so why do you think HR risk is an afterthought in organizations?
It's tricky. I think one of the reasons is probably how the function of HR is viewed, regardless of the sector. It has been seen as a transactional function. So you're responsible for hiring and firing, as horrible as that sounds. You're responsible for making sure people are paid. There isn't a strategic sense or view of HR in terms of being a business partner, the way that accounting or other functions are seen. And because there is an even balance of power in terms of supply and demand, where organizations will know there will always be labor supply, right? People leave, they can always replace them. So there's little investment in retaining people and developing an environment that is conducive in a sense of employee well-being, positive employee experience. The bottom line for many organizations is, let's get the job done. Let's get the profits in. Let's get the results done, the outcomes that we're aiming at. The human side of it has been a long, not ignored, but not so much focused on aspect of how organizations function. And what's interesting to see as businesses evolve or as the operating environment evolves is how much more sophisticated the labor market has become. So what people prioritize, like job security, long-term commitment to an organization, has evolved into something else, into well-being, into job satisfaction, even if it means working 4 jobs over 4 years. People are looking for something different. And I do not think that organizations have recognized that shift in how the labor supply is going to look in the future and has already started to look as the world evolves and as globalization takes more effect on how we operate globally across organizations and across sectors. So I think maybe that's why it's not given so much attention. And as you said, Sabrina, people agree that it makes sense. Yes, it makes sense. Let's look at HR risks. Unfortunately, it ends up being on a piece of paper and less an operational aspect of the business. So we have a great HR risk management framework or great HR risk register, but hardly anyone comes back to check on that and see where we're at in terms of mitigating those risks or planning ahead for those risks, or whether we have improved on standing on specific risks and how much impact they have on the organization.
Well, Izzy, anybody who listens to this podcast regularly or reads what I write on LinkedIn knows that I agree 100% with you when it comes to the usefulness of risk registers or risk frameworks that are written on a piece of paper and dusted off maybe once a quarter if you're lucky, but not really integrated into the ways of working. And we all know on Team Tolerable Risk here, that is not the best way to manage risk. Let me ask you, speaking of risks in the HR area, what are the top 3 risks in HR that you think third sector organizations should be aware of?
I'll repeat what people probably already know, but it bears emphasis because as much as it's known, it's not really acted upon as much as it should. So I think the very first one is that operational risk of having and retaining the right skills, especially in a volatile and ever-changing environment that we're in right now. It's really key to have HR processes that ensure that we have the right talent, that we develop the talent, that we keep that talent. We have these growing trends like quiet quitting, the great resignation, the war for talent, and whatever other fancy words we might have. They're all just revolving around the fact that organizations struggle to not just identify the right talent so that there's the right job person fit, but keeping that talent and making sure that it remains relevant to the organization's bottom line, right? So most businesses fail to deliver because of the poor job person fit, but also because of poor organizational structures, poor systems, and poor procedures. HR plays a significant role in ensuring that those things are done in the right way, for one, but also in an efficient way and a sustainable way for the future, right? So organizations need to be agile in how they manage their talent. So that's the first one, I would say. The second is reputational. And I say this because internal branding is what most organizations forget to do. They focus on external branding. So we want to take care of our stakeholders, our partners, our clients, our customers, but less focus is given to internal branding, which is taking care of the internal customer, the employee, the leadership, right? And the effects of failing to invest in this will eventually spill over onto the external branding. It's been said, I think, many times that a strong reputation, a strong image or brand that has taken years to establish, it's just a single social media post away from ruin, right? And that can be avoided by ensuring that the internal branding is robust and is effective and we take care of our people internally. It's as simple as that. The third one would be a legal risk in terms of malpractice and disputes that arise. And this one relates to the first two, especially relates to the reputational risk, the internal branding risk. When risk management frameworks and strategies incorporate HR perspectives of how the business is managed, it puts the position in a better position to identify and mitigate the gaps in operational practices that result in these other two risks. So I would say, at the risk of repeating things that have been said by others before, these are really the main ones, and they will continue to be risks that organizations need to confront head on.
I really like what you said, Izzy, about the internal reputation and making sure that you are taking care of that and ensuring that the staff that you have are receiving the right messaging and are working in the right kind of environment. There's a lot of talk in the risk profession about making sure people can speak up and speak out, making sure that there's psychological safety in an organization, making sure that you're addressing a toxic environment. What are a few things that small to medium-sized nonprofits can do, either A, to create these environments, or B, more likely what we hear about is when you realize that you have a toxic environment, what can they do to fix it?
That is such a, I think, a very relevant question and a tricky one as well, because I think psychological safety is such a big topic concept that many fail to fully appreciate. And many will either jump onto the bandwagon and do whatever everybody else is doing, or they will make assumptions about what is needed and implement that. I think the trick to it is to listen to the people that you're working with, that you've brought in to deliver what you want in terms of your business objectives. And it becomes a joint responsibility on establishing that psychological contract, building goodwill between the employer and the employee and whatever other players are in between that relationship is essential to ensuring that the working environment works for both parties. But when assumptions are made, when there are no platforms to speak, and when there is no openness to actually hear and accept where you're going wrong, there's not going to be any movement in terms of progressing the psychological safety and positive working environment that needs to be present for success in any business. So I think for me, the aspect of listening, businesses will invest a lot of money in investigating or bringing in experts and designing this shiny policy and tools to implement to ensure that people feel safe. But they will only remain tools unless they have value to the people you need psychological safety for. So that should be your starting point. Discuss with them, but to discuss with them, you need to prove that you are open to listening without any intimidation, without any repercussion. Often employees are afraid that when they speak up, they become the problem child and the target of dismissal. So I think for me, organizations need to just take a step back and go the simple way. Dialogue, but dialogue followed up with action, because people feel safe when they see that action is being taken regarding concerns and that there's a genuine in finding out what those concerns are.
Absolutely. I think you're talking about retaliation and people's fear of being retaliated against if they speak up. A lot of other examples that I've heard about when it comes to risk in the HR sector has to do with managing high-performing bullies. A lot of organizations will have a project manager who's just amazing, but you know, he's just a disaster to work with, or a fundraiser who's great at bringing money in the door, but she just, you know, can't get along with people or is just really cruel. What's a good way for organizations to think about and address a high-performing bully?
I think it all starts from the recruitment process. Now, I know that when you are going through a selection process, it's kind of a dance. You're performing, the organization is presenting a picture of who they are. So things might not always come out the way they really are during a selection process. But there are ways to ensure that how an organization recruits actually manages what we call talented terrorists. So what I mean by this is, when you're looking for somebody who has technical expertise in a specific area, it needs to be balanced by attitude, certain people or interrelational competences and skills, specific leadership skills that allow them to have the self-awareness, the emotional intelligence to be able to balance the soft skills as well as the hard skills. So when it starts from the recruitment process, you ensure that you're bringing in the right people with the right attitudes, with the right values, that ensures a good overall job percentage. People often recruit for the hard skills and less for the soft skills. It should be a combination of both. Now, supposing you've gone through the recruitment process and some will still sift through that selection process and their true colors come out. The role of HR is significant in the sense that developing comprehensive leadership programs, leadership development programs, behavioral development programs to instill a certain kind of value or leadership quality that you're looking for to ensure that those leading people are empowered or equipped to do so. Because it doesn't come naturally to everybody. And some people are thrown into leadership roles without any kind of training or support to do that and may not be aware that they've become a talented terrorist. So programs like this enable you to deal with some of those gaps in having a wholesome team that is able to work either cohesively.
Can you give a couple of examples, Izzy, of how somebody can identify some of this during recruitment? Because a lot of the folks who are listening to the podcast are working at very small organizations. So are there some types of questions, or what if they're hiring somebody, what are some of the red flags? What are some of the things that they can do to identify this ahead of time?
Sure. So yes, there is small things that you can look into, but it's a pretty sensitive area or topic, because recruitment, as I said, is probably a one-off experience you're going to have with the organization. Now, if you're coming in from a bad day and you have an interview, how you relate to the selection panel might make you come across as somebody who is inflexible or unreasonable. Or somebody who is naturally unreasonable could come off as quite charming in an interview because they're prepared for it. So there are a number of ways, and I think this is why we have different stages in a selection process. I don't quite subscribe to 6, 7, 8 interviews, but I do believe that having a few stages in a selection process to identify how people interact with the selection panel, but not just the panel, not just the interview panel, other people involved. So if it's a face-to-face interview or an in-person interview, how have they dealt with the receptionists? If they're coming in for a CEO interview, how have they related with the janitor who they just met at the door, or the security guard, or whom they might have come across as they need to reach the interview? How have they handled maybe a technical issue with a computer whilst they were doing a practical assessment? How have they related to other candidates? For example, if you're doing a group assessment where there is a group discussion. So HR processes have various tests that allow that assessment to be done. Some of it is quite scientific, but I think some of it is a bit more qualitative in terms of observing the candidate. And I think the emergence of virtual interviewing and video interviewing has kind of robbed us from some of those physical cues that you can pick up when you interview people in person. But it has also been good in terms of seeing how people relate to digital technology and issues like that. So all of these things are related to how people deal with other people. So you might ask, what's a computer issue? What's me getting frustrated with a computer got to do with how I lead people? Being a leader is, I think, a confluence of various aspects of who you are as a person and how you relate with the environment around you. I risk sounding ideological here, but I think a well-structured selection process, well-trained hiring managers, and well-informed candidates make it possible for you to pick up some of those red flags. And I think some people work with instinct, so feel this one might be a problem, but I hesitate to allow such things when I'm running a selection process because some of those instincts are potentially unconscious bias. So it's important for people to be trained and ensure that there is a structured and objective way of identifying some of these red flags, either through these structured cognitive assessments or through practical assessments or through just general immersion of candidates into the working environment. It could be a visit to the office, or it could be a tour of a manufacturing plant or something. But there's so many ways that people could use to ensure that they pick up on this as much as possible. And it's not foolproof. People want to present their best side, right? And it's only normal for us to do that. Organizations do that as well. They present the best side of who they are as an employer. The idea is not to eliminate all of these things. The idea is to identify them so that if they are present, those training programs that I initially mentioned can either address them or can help to mitigate them or to neutralize them so that someone becomes a positively functioning member of a team or leader of a team.
That's an excellent answer. Very thorough, Izzy. Thanks. And one of the things you mentioned was remote working environments. Now, during COVID, we know a lot of people really kind of crashed hard into remote working and then rebuilt from there. Some organizations had been doing remote all along, but a lot of them hadn't. And now with this sort of concept of hybrid working or trying to get people back in the office, what are some of the things that small to medium-sized organizations who are considering hybrid working or are considering going fully remote, what are some of the things they should think about when it comes to creating an organizational culture if your staff is remote?
Great question. I think one of the main struggles is ensuring team cohesion, team spirit. A well-glued team is pretty difficult when people are in different positions or working remotely. It's far easier when you have everybody in one place and can do a quick team huddle or quickly jump off to a team lunch or an office lunch and things like that, small things like that. A lot of extra effort has to be made when people are working remotely to identify where their gaps in bringing the team together. A lot of considerations have to be made about, for example, time zones. It sounds pretty simple, but it can be a nightmare to organize a meeting of 20 people in 8 different locations, especially if they're in the extremes. You have somebody in Australia and somebody else in Washington, D.C. It becomes problematic. You also need to watch out for how you engage with the team. When people moved to working remotely, a lot of issues of isolation and depression came up. And this is a pretty serious issue because it can really affect not just one team member, but the entire team, an entire organization even, and can have serious consequences. So managers need to be really attuned to their teams, but there is a risk of being intrusive in people's minds. So it's a balance that as a manager, you have to make to identify how your team members function. You have introverts, you have extroverts, you have ambiverts, you have people coming from a culture that has a high power distance where they're used to being given direction and where they have a certain view of authority. And we have others coming from a low power distance culture where they value their autonomy, where power is to be questioned. So as a manager, you need to be attuned to all of that, identify it, and figure out ways to engage with team members according to who they are and how they work, so that you keep your finger on the pulse of the team and ensure that you bring people together. And there's so many ways to do that. Simple Google search right now would show you how to engage with your virtual team. But I think it comes down to the type of manager you have, the type of leadership skills you have, to be able to steer some of these engagements and ensure that the team is productive, but also well looked after so that they are productive as can be.
Thank you for that. It's a lot of great things to think about when it comes to remote. And I know people have a lot of passionate thoughts about it. Some people think it's great. Some people think it's the end of times. But like you said, organizations are made up of people. And so you're probably going to have people on your team or in your organization who believe all of the above. So the question is, how are you best going to manage them? So thank you for those suggestions. That's great. So what is some advice that you would give leadership and management to best engage with managing and being aware of and mitigating HR risk? If you could tell leadership and management in your perfect organization some things for them to do, some things for them to be aware of, some things for them to think about, what would you advise them?
That's a good one as well. Got all these great questions for me today. I think one of the main things that leadership can do to best engage with HR risks is first and foremost to empower HR itself as a function by effectively positioning the role of HR to be a strategic partner. And for them to do this, they need to fully understand what the role of HR is. We still surprisingly have people who perceive HR as a transactional function and not as a strategic function, and don't fully recognize the delicate balance that HR maintains between organizational interests and people relations, which don't always align, by the way. So empowering HR in terms of positioning means that the sensitivity of people risks is taken into account when HR has a direct line to the executive, right? And not filtered by other functional agendas. And here what I mean is, oftentimes you find HR is placed under finance, under business operations, sometimes even under the legal function or the ethics function. My personal view is that this creates a layer that is weighted by that specific area of expertise, right? So if it is placed under finance, then the people perspective is not always going to be the agenda of the finance lead, of the lead of that function. So I think the independence of functions in an organization is essential, and the sensitivity of people management requires a direct line to the executive. So when that happens, it empowers HR to speak strategically about people management risks and about how they impact the overall business strategy. So basically, I think for me, that risk requires proactive and deliberate inclusion of HR at the table, not just as a visitor, but as a strategic partner in discussions. But it works both ways as well. So HR, to be a strategic partner, needs to be fully aware of the business and its essential direction. So HR is not working in a box and just ticking off how they hire people, how they train people, how they pay people. They are fully understanding what the organizational strategy is, and they have the business sense to draft HR strategies that align fully with business strategies. And I think that makes a great partnership when it is structured that way. So that's basically what I think leadership, whether they're board or management, can do to ensure that HR risks are accounted for and acted on.
I think that's such a great point that you raised, Izzy, about making sure that HR has a seat at the table and not just as a guest or a visitor, but really a seat at the table. Again, you said earlier in our conversation, organizations are made up of people, and why on earth is HR and are HR risks an afterthought? This, again, goes back to supporting that point 100%, making sure that HR has a voice in strategy, in identifying objectives, in decision-making. It's so important to be able to manage those risks when, at the end of the day, your organization's made up of people. So that's a really great point. I specifically want to ask you about boards. We know that at the board level, they tend not to be involved in the day-to-day operations, that sort of leadership and management. But like you said, organizations are made up of people and there's risks in HR. So what would you say would be a couple of questions that board members in particular should be asking relating to HR risk?
So I think, in as much as they're not involved in the day-to-day operations, any board should have a good sense of how things are. So a good question to ask would be, what is the current mood or climate with our people? And how is our culture, our identity as an organization contributing, reinforcing or inhibiting a conducive environment for our people to deliver what we want them to deliver the value to the stakeholders? Asking that simple question makes sure that the leadership is checking in with HR in terms of employee engagement, job satisfaction, productivity, and all of those things that make up a good working environment. It also ensures that HR is accountable as well for developing or structuring the working environment the way that it should be in terms of strategies and tools and procedures and frameworks. So that's one of the questions I would say that we should ask. The second, I suppose, should be, initially I talked about making sure that we choose the right people. So the second question would be, assuming that we have the right talent, do we have the right leadership, and have we positioned and empowered the leadership to be effective leaders of this organization? Because what often happens is that people say an organization is as good as its leaders, but often the leaders are not empowered enough to direct the organization the way that it's supposed to be. So that's essential for the board to ensure that leaders are equipped, aligned in terms of the values and the goals of the organization, and know how to be leaders. I think it's as simple as that. They need to know how to be leaders, because the mood of an organization, the direction of an organization will change with its leaders. So imagine having four leaders in a period of 2 years. It would mean that when this new leader comes in, the direction changes and employees are shifted all the way to move into that direction. And a new leader comes in who thinks differently or who wants things done in a different way. And again, the entire organization, all the people within it, are shifted towards that direction. It is exhausting for the people on the ground, the operations on the ground. It is exhausting to have to keep up with the different types of leadership that are coming in. So when the board sets a tone for the kind of leadership that is wanted, that is desired, and that is essential for an organization, and if it asks that question about how do we ensure that we bring that on board and align them to what we would like, then I think that addresses some of these HR risks that we've been talking about. It also ensures that there's continued alignment between leadership and boards, because that's one of the reasons why some organizations become irrelevant or unsustainable. So I think those are two critical questions that board members can ask.
Thank you for that, Izzy. That's some great advice for board members, for current board members, or maybe aspiring board members who are going to be serving on third sector boards. So HR is a changing dynamic area of expertise, as is risk. Can you talk a little bit about how you stay on top of the changing waves of knowledge in HR, and particularly, how do you stay on top of the risks that are continually emerging from this area?
Absolutely. Our world is changing every day. The HR competencies people had 10 years ago are not the same that are required now. In fact, 3 years ago, before COVID hit, a new type of skill was required for HR practitioners to deal with that effectively. So I think what's important at a professional level is to maintain memberships with professional bodies, especially the international ones or the well-known ones like the CIPD, SHRM. They give a huge range of resources, of networking that allow people to keep, or HR professionals to keep up to date with news and developments and to debate some of these really critical topics and contentious topics and start to map contemporary ways to deal with them. And on an organizational level, I think staying on top of risks requires regular temperature checks to ensure integrity of systems, of processes, of strategies, of decision-making processes, of accountability structures. And that ensures that the organization keeps up to date with best practices and aligns with them. And I think finally, organizations can engage their people, basically just engage people to be aware of risks, engage technical experts when needed, but trust your own people to do the work because they are familiar with it and they will know when things are going wrong and sometimes have the solutions that we just tend to overlook because we're looking for a specific expert or so-called expert in a certain field. So I think doing some of those things could help in terms of keeping up to date with changing information and keeping tabs with the trends around the world.
So for organizations that may not have an HR professional like you on staff, for organizations that are small and, like you were saying, maybe the HR function sits under finance or operations or administration or even legal, if they don't have an HR expert on staff, but they want to make sure they're doing the right thing, are there any online platforms, reading resources, continuing education opportunities that might be slightly different from credentialing, but that they can access in a low resource or no resource environment so that they can do right by their employees and make sure that they have a good organizational culture?
It's a great question because I think often when we talk, especially when I'm talking, I'm considering a well-established or international organization, and we tend to forget that there's smaller businesses who won't have a defined HR structure or a defined HR team that has a number of people. So I think the first place to start is ensuring that HR accountability falls somewhere, right? Whether it is with the owner, the business owner, whether it is with the operations manager or whoever it is, ensure that it is a formal accountability. It could be written into the job description and ensure that the person is trained in terms of HR. So there are various resources they could go to, but I think what's important, especially for the smaller businesses, is finding out what local HR community is available for them to tap into. You will find in many countries there are HR forums where either practitioners in the third sector meet regularly or practitioners in all sectors meet regularly, or some of these forums are actually organized by, it could be the Ministry of Labor in the country, so the statutory. So feeding into some of these platforms is pretty helpful for small businesses or enterprises to keep up to date with changes in law, changes in practice, changes in industry standards. And if there is the capacity to do that, then looking at other wider communities, social platforms like LinkedIn has a great HR community that allows formal and informal interaction about managing people, about risks. As I mentioned, CIPD, SHRM, are good resources for those. And those are just two of the ones that I mostly interact with. But there's so many global HR platforms that can assist leaders who are not necessarily HR leaders to come to terms with some of the difficulties that organizations encounter when they're managing people.
Thanks, Izzy. Those are some great resources. So as we're kind of winding down here, is there anything that we didn't cover? Do you have any final thoughts, any words of wisdom for small to medium-sized NGOs that are wrestling with HR and want to make sure that they're managing their HR-related risk really well?
Anything else? I think we've had such a great conversation. It feels good to actually discuss some of these things and share some of my perceptions. I think one of the key things that I would like to leave to our listeners today is that HR is not the monster it's put out to be. And managing people is a management function that all leaders should, I think, be able to undertake, whatever their role, because managing people is essential to you delivering as a manager in any team or as a leader. And you cannot separate that from your role or your technical expertise. While it is a joint responsibility, the role of HR is to structure it and to enable managers to do that. What I would say to people is just to build their trust in the HR function, to empower them, to give them the right guidance, to develop the right structures that are needed for people to effectively do their jobs. So HR is a support structure that you need to effectively manage your talent. But the actual doing of managing talent rests on managers to ensure that they develop a cohesive team and a productive team and good relationships with the people that they manage. So that would be my final thought for today.
I think that's such an important point, Izzy. The same way that we like to say we are all risk managers, right? Risk doesn't just sit with the chief risk officer. It's something that really needs to be integrated and embedded and built into an organization instead of bolted on. And I don't know if you would agree and say that HR is the same thing. I love what you said. HR is not this particular unit's. Managing people is not just this unit's responsibility. It is every manager's responsibility to manage people. And so thinking about it that way and really making sure that the skills and the awareness is embedded in everybody's day-to-day role is really important.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely agree.
That's wonderful. Thanks, Izzy. So if people really enjoyed listening to us chat today and they want to learn more about you or reach out to you if they have any questions, where can they find you?
I'm available on LinkedIn. They can just look up my profile, Isabel Genosi. I regularly check it and I regularly interact with people there. So I think that would be the best place to find me.
Great. So thank you so much for coming on the show today, Izzy. It was such a pleasure to chat with you. And I think we've hit on a lot of really important things for small organizations, medium-sized organizations to think about in the area of HR. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for letting me talk about something that is truly a passion of mine. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, we can tell it's a passion of yours and you're good at it too. Thanks so much, Izzy. So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.